often held venomously racist views of the Japanese, Japanese soldiers and civilians usually carried caustic prejudices about their enemies, seeing them as brutish beasts or fearsome devils. This racism and the hatred and fear it generated further inspired abuse of Allied prisoners. From earliest childhood, Japanese citizens were taught that to surrender or be captured was intolerably shameful. The Japanese military field code made clear what was expected of men facing capture. Rather than live and bear the shame of imprisonment, the soldier must die and avoid leaving a dishonorable name. In many hopeless battles, virtually every Japanese soldier fought to the death. At times, soldiers committed mass suicide to avoid surrender. The revulsion most Japanese felt for those who were captured extended to Allied servicemen. To abuse, enslave, and even murder a prisoner was acceptable, even desirable. Though under great pressure to conform to a culture of brutality, a few guards refused to join the violence. Such humane behavior took nerve. Everywhere in Japan, demonstrating sympathy for captives or POWs was taboo. Guards caught trying to help prisoners, or even voicing compassion for them, were beaten. At Ofuna, one guard who was kind to captives endured nightly gang attacks from his fellow guards. Deaths from beating and malnourishment were common in Ofuna. For captives, the only hope lay in rescue by the Allies, but this prospect carried tremendous danger. In 1942, when America attacked Japanese ships near Tarawa Atoll, the Japanese beheaded 22 POWs held there. In 1943, when the Americans bombed Japanese-held Balali, the Japanese executed some 70 to 100 POWs they'd enslaved on the island. Then, shortly after Louis arrived at Ofuna, American ships attacked Wake, where the 98 captured Americans were still being used as slaves. The Japanese promptly shot all the prisoners. These mass murders were the first applications of Japan's kill-all rule. If Allied advances made the rescue of POWs possible, POWs must be executed. A message sent to all POW camp commanders stated, "Whether they are destroyed individually or in groups or however it is done, with mass bombing, poisonous smoke, poisons, drowning, decapitation, or what, dispose of them as the situation dictates. It is the aim not to allow the escape of a single one, to annihilate them all, and not to leave any traces." As the Allies fought their way toward Japan, the kill-all order loomed over the Ofuna captives. Like every other captive, Louis knew the guards were eagerly awaiting the chance to carry it out. Chapter 20. Farting for Hirohito. At first, there was silence and isolation. At night, no one spoke. Come daylight, Louis was suddenly in a crowd, hustled outside and herded in crazy circles, but with eyes obediently down, mouth obediently closed, he was no less alone. The only break in the gloom came from a guard who would saunter down the barracks aisle, pause before each cell, raise one leg, and fart at each captive. He never quite succeeded in farting his way down the entire cell block. In stolen glances, nods, and hushed words, Louis sorted out Ofuna. Most men in his barracks were Americans, survivors of sunken ships or crashed planes. Down the hall lived an American Navy officer, Commander John Fitzgerald, captured after he scuttled his burning submarine. The Japanese had tried to torture information out of Fitzgerald, clubbing him, jamming knives under his fingernails, tearing his fingernails off, and pouring water up his nose until he passed out. Fitzgerald had never broken, and, as one of the highest-ranking captives, did his best to protect the men. During forced exercise, Louis fell into step with a young Marine named William Harris. Captured in the Philippines in 1942, Harris had escaped, diving into Manila Bay and embarking on an 8.5-hour swim. Wading ashore on the Japanese-occupied Bataan Peninsula, he'd hiked through jungles and over mountains, sailed in borrowed boats and hitched rides on burros, surviving in part by eating ants. He'd nearly made it to Australia by boat when civilians turned him in to the Japanese. Each day, Louis and Harris hung together, laboring through forced exercise, bearing the guards' blows and whispering. The curious thing about Harris was that while he was tall, 6'2" or 3", virtually everyone, including Louis, would remember him as a giant, as tall as 6'10". In a sense, Louis and the others were right. Harris was a genius. Highly educated, conversant in several languages, he had a perfect photographic memory. A captive once found him with hands parted as if holding a book. Asked what he was doing, Harris said he was reading a text he'd studied in school. In Ofuna, his astounding memory would be a blessing and a terrible curse. Ofuna had one other notable resident. Gaga was a duck who limped around on a broken leg that a captive had fitted with a splint. Everywhere the captives went, Gaga peg-legged with them. A captive would later swear that when the men bowed toward the emperor, Gaga bowed in imitation. In so dark a place, this cheerful bird became especially beloved. Louis rarely saw Phil, who was housed down the hall. The pilot was frail, his eyes haunted. Once, when Louis shuffled up next to him outside, Phil finally spoke of the crash. He said he felt responsible for his men's deaths. Louis tried to reassure him that the crash wasn't his fault. Phil was unswayed. "I'll never fly again," he said. As Louis adjusted to Ofuna, he noticed something strange. Every other captive was relentlessly interrogated, but he was never questioned. Clearly, the Japanese had no interest in what he knew. They had some reason for subjecting him to the misery of Ofuna, but he had no idea what it was. Louis soon discovered that Ofuna's submissive silence was an illusion. Beneath the hush was a humming underground of defiance. It began with sidelong whispers. Men scribbled notes on toilet paper and hid them for each other in the benjo. Exploiting the silence rule's loophole, captives were permitted to speak to guards. They'd approach the guards in groups and speak English, using a querying tone. The confused guards thought they were being asked questions, but the men were really speaking to each other. At night, if the guards stepped away from the cells, the whole barracks would start tapping out Morse code. Outside, in daytime, Louis and the others whispered in code, tit for dot and da for dash, words that could be spoken without moving the lips. Others hid their hands and gestured. A fist was a dot, a flat hand, a dash. Because guards who caught captives speaking about them often responded with savage beatings, the men gave them nicknames, including turd bird, flange face, the weasel, liver lip, and termite. One guard was especially feared. He was a medical officer, a sadist, who tortured and beat captives for pleasure. A massive man, he punched like a heavyweight. They called him the Quack. The defiance took on a life of its own. Men smiled and addressed guards in friendly tones, cooing out filthy insults. One captive convinced a particularly daft guard that a sundial would work at night if he used a match. A favorite pastime involved saving up intestinal gases, explosively abundant thanks to dysentery, before roll call. Ordered to bow toward Emperor Hirohito, the captives would pitch forward and fart in unison. Louis had another private act of rebellion. A captive gave him a tiny book he'd made from rice paste flattened into pages. On the central pages, Louis made it seem a harmless address book. In faint script, upside down in the back, he kept a diary, forbidden at Ofuna. He hid the diary under a loose board in his cell. With daily cell inspections, discovery was likely, and would surely bring a clubbing. But the diary was precious to Louis. He knew he might die here. He wanted to leave a record of what he had endured and who he had been. After food, what the men wanted most was war news. The Japanese sealed the camps from war information and told the captives preposterous stories of Allied losses, even announcing that their military had shot Abraham Lincoln and torpedoed Washington, D.C. "They couldn't understand why we laughed," said a prisoner. Ofuna officials had no idea the captives were following the war in spite of them. New captives were questioned by fellow captives, the news tapping through camp in minutes. The Japanese rarely brought newspapers in, but when one did, stealing it was a camp-wide obsession. Stolen papers were passed to Harris and Fitzgerald, who spoke Japanese. As translations were done, lookouts stood by. When guards neared, the papers vanished, soon to be put to their final use. In a camp with a lot of diarrhea and little toilet paper, newspapers were priceless. Knowing the Allies were winning was immensely inspiring, enabling men to hang on a little longer. But that wasn't the only benefit of the stealing and defiance. Through acts of resistance, dignity was preserved, and through dignity, life itself. Everyone knew what the consequences would be if anyone was caught stealing papers. At the time, it seemed worth the risk. In the fall, snow came, gliding through gaps in the barracks walls. Wearing the summer clothes he'd crashed in, Louis shivered. Shut outside all day, he and the others huddled, mixing slowly to give each man time in the warmer middle. The rations dwindled. Unloading ration trucks, captives saw nutritious fare, but it was never served to them, because the Japanese were stealing it. The most flagrant thief was the cook, who packed the food on his bicycle and pedaled off to sell it. He reportedly bought and furnished a house with his profits. The stealing left Ofuna in famine. Most captives were emaciated, but Louis was the thinnest. The rations weren't nearly enough, and he was plagued by diarrhea. He teetered through the forced exercise. Once he collapsed. Sprawled on the ground, he heard laughter. Learning that Louis was a former Olympian, the guards brought in a Japanese runner for a match race. Forced to run, Louis was trounced, and the guards mocked him. He was angry and shaken, and his growing weakness scared him. Prisoners were dying by the thousands in Japan's camps, and winter was coming. Captives stepped in to save Louis. A Norwegian gave him a coat, and each day, at enormous risk to themselves, the captive kitchen workers snuck him an extra handful of food, which Louis split with Phil. Grateful, Louis hung on. At the end of 1943, the captives had a taste of liberation. Veteran captives, Louis included, were allowed to speak outside. When new captives arrived, they were whisked into solitary confinement until initial interrogation was over. In early 1944, Louis was tracked down by a new captive just out of solitary. He was an amputee, one leg gone. His name was Fred Garrett, and he'd been a B-24 pilot. Amazed to see Louis, he told a remarkable story. In December, America had bombed Japanese bases in the Marshall Islands. Garrett was shot down, incurring a gaping ankle fracture. Captured, he was thrown into a cell block with 19 other Americans. His ankle became severely infected, Maggots hatched in it, and Garrett began running a high fever. He was told he'd be given medical care only if he divulged military secrets. If not, he'd be killed. Garrett lied in interrogation, and the Japanese knew it. Garrett was tied down, given a spinal anesthetic, and forced to watch as a Japanese corpsman sawed his leg off. Though the infection was limited to the ankle, the corpsman cut Garrett's entire leg off so he could never fly a plane again. Delirious, Garrett was shipped to Ofuna with two other captives. The 17 Americans left behind were never seen again. As he'd lain in agony in his cell, Garrett had seen 10 names scratched into the wall. He was told the first 9 had been executed. No one told him the fate of the 10th man. Garrett had long thought about the last man. When he'd arrived at Ofuna, he'd asked if anyone knew that man. His name was Louis Zamperini. Garrett and Louis, both Los Angeles area natives, had been imprisoned in the same tiny Kwajalein cell almost 5,000 miles from home. Plodding around the compound that winter, Louis and Harris befriended Frank Tinker, a pilot who'd been brought from Kwajalein with Garrett. The three stuck together, distracting each other from the cold with mind exercises. Louis strengthened his legs, lifting his knees high as he walked. The guards began goading him into running. In spring, the guards brought in another Japanese runner and ordered Louis to race him, warning that if he refused, all captives would be punished. Louis lagged behind with no intention of winning, but his body was so light that running was surprisingly easy. He saw captives watching him, breathless. As the finish approached, they started cheering. Louis knew what would happen if he won, but the cheering aroused his defiance. He lengthened his stride, seized the lead, and crossed the line. The captives whooped. Louis didn't see the guard's club coming at his skull. He just felt the world tip and go away. His eyes opened to the sight of the sky, ringed in his friends' faces. It had been worth it. In March, Phil was taken away, bound for what officials called a plush POW camp. He and Louis had a brief goodbye. They spoke of finding each other again someday, when the war was over. Phil was led away. Phil's new camp, Ashio, was far from plush. Ashio's POWs were enslaved in a copper mine in horrendous conditions. But there, Phil was told he could write home. He hadn't seen Ceci or his family in well over 2 years, and knew they probably thought he was dead. He wrote about the raft, his capture, and yearning for home. "The first night home we'll hear some interesting tales," he wrote. "Much love, till we're together again." The Japanese never mailed his letter. It was found in the garbage, partially burned. Phil reclaimed it. If he lived through this war, he'd deliver it in person. Chapter 21 Belief. Behind Torrance High stood a huddle of trees. On many evenings after her brother disappeared, Louis's sister Sylvia would drive to the school, turn her car under the trees, and park. As the car cooled, tears would stream down Sylvia's cheeks. Sometimes she'd let herself sob, knowing no one would hear. Then she'd dry her face, straighten herself, and start the car again. On the drive home, she'd think of a lie to explain why she'd been gone so long. She never told anyone how frightened she was. In Torrance, the June 1943 telegram announcing Louis's disappearance was followed by weeks of excruciating silence. In town, hope dissolved. In the Zamperini house, the mood was different. In the first days after the telegram arrived, Louise Zamperini had been seized with the conviction that her son was alive. Her husband and children had felt the same. Weeks passed, but the family's confidence was unshaken. On July 13th, Louise felt a wave of urgency. She wrote to the 7th Air Force commander and begged him to keep searching. Her son, she said, was alive. Unbeknownst to Louise, on that very day, Louis was captured.